Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake has been hailed as one of the most prescient dystopian novels of our time, landing on Barack Obama's recommended reading list and inspiring the Emmy-winning Hulu series The Handmaid's Tale. Published in 2003 as the first installment of her Mad Atom trilogy, the novel eerily predicted many of our current anxieties about genetic engineering, corporate power, and environmental collapse. The Guardian called it a landmark work of speculative fiction, while the New York Times praised Atwood's pitch-perfect command of language. The book follows the journey of Snowman, possibly the last human survivor of a bioengineered apocalypse, as he navigates a world where humanity has been replaced by a new species designed by his brilliant but disturbed friend Crake. Through Snowman's memories, we witness how scientific hubris and corporate greed created the perfect storm that ended civilization as we know it. Snowman wakes before dawn on a beach, wrapped in a dirty bedsheet toga, his Red Sox cap perched on his head, a relic from the vanished world. Once he was Jimmy, a good boy with a future. But now he's possibly the last human alive, surviving on meager supplies and weekly fish offerings from the children of Crake, genetically engineered humanoids with luminous green eyes who regard him with curious fascination. These beautiful, naked beings approach him on the beach, chanting, "Snowman, oh, snowman," keeping a respectful distance, perhaps out of reverence, perhaps because of his stench. They show him treasures collected from the ruins, a hubcap, piano key, pop bottle fragment, computer mouse. "These are things from before," he explains in his kindly, remote voice. They stare at his difference, occasionally asking to see his sunglasses removed and replaced, curious about his eyes. When they ask about the moss on his face, he answers, "Feathers," the same response he gives weekly. The crackers have developed theories about him. That he was once a bird who forgot how to fly, that he's cold from eating fish, that he's missing his man thing. They represent Crake's aesthetic vision, perfect humans with varying skin tones, but all with identical green eyes. They're innocent, peaceful, and utterly alien to Snowman, who feels his humanity slipping away with each passing day. "Now I'm alone," Snowman says aloud after they leave, desperate to hear a human voice in this silent world. Sometimes he imitates animal sounds or screams obscenities at the ocean. Looking down at his grimy, bug-bitten body with thinning hair and yellowing toenails, he laments his physical decline. "Crake," he screams at the ocean. "Asshole, shit for brains, you did this." Receiving no answer but the waves' wishwash, he wipes tears and mango juice from his face. "Snowman, snowman," he says, "get a life." Before the collapse, Jimmy grew up in the Organ Inc. Farms compound, a corporate enclave that exemplified humanity's attempt to create perfect, controlled environments amid growing global chaos. These compounds were fortress-like communities separated from the deteriorating pleblands, cities, by imposing walls, razor wire, and sophisticated security systems, including armed corpse corps guards, biometric scanners, and constant surveillance. His father worked as a senior genographer on the groundbreaking Pigoon project, developing transgenic pigs, sus multi-organifer, engineered to grow human-compatible organs. These creatures represented a revolutionary advancement in transplant medicine. Each pig could simultaneously grow multiple organs, including hearts, kidneys, and liver tissue. Unlike traditional donor animals, pigoons could be harvested repeatedly through minimally invasive procedures, making them a sustainable source of organs. The project promised massive profits for Organ Inc. while addressing the chronic shortage of transplant organs. The compounds created a stark social hierarchy, with scientific elites living in climate-controlled comfort, while the pleblands descended into environmental degradation and social unrest. Inside, residents enjoyed pristine lawns, well-stocked shops, excellent schools, and state-of-the-art medical facilities. Jimmy's mother increasingly rebelled against this artificial existence, describing it as a soul-destroying theme park where people played at recreating a sanitized version of the past. She particularly despised the carefully curated shopping centers and recreational facilities designed to create an illusion of normal life. His father, by contrast, embraced compound living, frequently citing statistics about rising crime and disease rates in the Pleblends. Young Jimmy's visits to the Pigoon facility required elaborate safety protocols, donning an oversized biosuit, double-layer face mask, and passing through multiple decontamination chambers. The Pigoonlets captivated him with their playful behavior, but the adult specimens proved more unsettling. Their human-derived neocortex tissue, intended to improve organ compatibility, gave them unnervingly intelligent eyes that seemed to study visitors with uncomfortable intensity. These creatures would later prove to be among humanity's most dangerous legacies, their enhanced cognitive capabilities allowing them to organize, plan, and hunt with frightening effectiveness in the post-pandemic world. The compounds represented more than just secure housing. They were self-contained worlds where corporations exercised near-total control over their employees' lives. Companies like Organ Inc., Healthwiser, and Rejuvenes operated their own schools, hospitals, and security forces. This corporate feudalism created a dangerous disconnect between scientific advancement and social responsibility. The scientists and executives making world-changing decisions lived in artificial bubbles, sheltered from the consequences of their actions on the broader population. When Jimmy's father received a lucrative offer from Nu Skins, the family relocated to the Healthwiser compound, a move that intensified his mother's sense of imprisonment. The enhanced security measures, including mandatory identity checks and restricted movement between compounds, particularly affected her. While his father justified these measures by referencing incidents of eco-terrorist attacks and corporate espionage, the oppressive atmosphere eventually contributed to his mother's dramatic escape, an event that would shape Jimmy's understanding of the true cost of their privileged existence. At Healthwiser High, Jimmy met Glenn, later known exclusively as Craik, a brilliant student with straight dark hair, green eyes, and a cool half-smile who wore dark clothes without logos. Unlike most of Jimmy's friends, Jimmy's mother actually liked Craik, describing him as intellectually honorable and more adult than a lot of adults. Their friendship was built on an uneasy power dynamic. Jimmy felt both drawn to and threatened by Craik, who had a way of giving people his full attention that made them feel important. Teachers and students alike were impressed by Craik's potential, though wary of him. After becoming lab partners in nanotech biochem, they began hanging out regularly, playing computer games in Craik's room rather than using physical game pieces, because, as Craik explained, the real set is in your head. The boys spent hours surfing the darkest corners of the internet, watching live surgeries, executions on headsoff.com and brainfrizz.com, assisted suicides on nightynight.com, and pornography including child exploitation sites like Hot Tots. Using Crepe's Uncle Pete's stolen password, they accessed forbidden sites while smoking stolen skunkweed. Jimmy would leave these sessions feeling disoriented, as if he'd participated in something beyond his control, while Craik remained unaffected by anything they watched. It was during one of these internet sessions that they first saw Oryx, a girl who appeared to be about 8 years old on the Hot Tot site. Unlike the other children who seemed like digital clones to Jimmy, Oryx immediately felt three-dimensional and real. During the scene, she paused and looked directly into the camera with a hard little smile that made her seem much older. That look said, "I see you watching. I know what you want." Craik froze the frame and downloaded it. Jimmy felt simultaneously guilty and captivated by this look, hooked through the gills. This moment planted the seeds for the catastrophe to come. Jimmy's obsession with Oryx and Craik's cold analytical view of humanity would eventually converge in the most devastating way possible. Their friendship, built on uneven ground, would become the axis upon which the fate of humanity would turn. Jimmy's childhood was marked by a profound sense of emotional abandonment. His mother, once a microbiologist at Organ Inc. Farms, quit when Jimmy started first grade, a timing that confused him since she claimed she'd stopped working to stay home with him. His beloved Filipino nanny, Dolores, was sent away, leaving him with a mother who was emotionally distant and unpredictable. Snowman remembers her sitting at the kitchen table in her magenta bathrobe, a color that still makes him anxious, smoking cigarettes, staring out windows, barely engaging as he made his own lunch. Jimmy desperately tried to make her laugh or gain her attention through silly antics. Occasionally, she'd surprise him with elaborate, carefully arranged lunches, open-faced peanut butter sandwiches with jelly smiles that matched her lipstick, during which she'd be all sparkling attention, but somehow hard and artificial, like a porcelain sink. His mother's mysterious disappearance when Jimmy was a teenager left a wound that never healed. She escaped cleverly, taking no luggage and using a routine dental appointment as cover. The Corps Corps security man who accompanied her never returned, suggesting accomplices were involved. Jimmy's father was deeply rattled by his wife's disappearance, as it reflected badly on him professionally. He was taken away for extended debriefing while two Corps Corps women stayed with Jimmy, attempting to extract information through friendly conversation. Jimmy received occasional postcards signed Aunt Monica from his mother, which prompted more Corps Corps questioning. Years later, during his fifth year at ONIU, Jimmy was shown footage of his mother being executed for treason. Her final words before being shot, "Goodbye. Remember, killer. I love you. Don't let me down." Meanwhile, Craig had his own family trauma. His father died under suspicious circumstances, supposedly a suicide off a Plebland overpass, though Craig believed otherwise, hinting at foul play involving Uncle Pete, who became suspiciously supportive afterward. Later, Craig lost his mother to what was officially called an accident, a transgenic staph infection that chewed through her like a solar mower. These parallel losses shaped both men in different ways. Jimmy buried his pain beneath layers of cynicism and casual relationships, while Craig channeled his into a cold, calculating worldview that would eventually lead him to orchestrate humanity's downfall. Oryx emerges as the narrative's most enigmatic figure, existing primarily through others' recollections and interpretations. Three distinct portraits of her emerge: Craig's analytical perspective, Jimmy's idealized version, and her own carefully measured self-disclosure. Her distinctive appearance, a delicate, triangular face with striking eyes and luminous complexion, made her memorable to all who encountered her. Her early life, shared sparingly with Jimmy, began in an unspecified Southeast Asian village. The precise location remained unclear, possibly Vietnam or Cambodia, though not Indonesia, Myanmar, or India. Following her father's passing, economic circumstances led to her entering what the villagers euphemistically called an apprenticeship system, a common practice in communities facing agricultural instability. A well-dressed businessman would visit such villages, presenting himself as a legitimate entrepreneur offering economic opportunities. The community viewed these arrangements as necessary survival strategies during periods of environmental and economic uncertainty. The practice was normalized within the cultural context, though it masked concerning realities. In the city, now known as Susu, Oryx initially worked as a flower vendor, where her youth and gentle demeanor proved advantageous. Her handler, Uncle N, later involved her in increasingly exploitative situations targeting tourists, until his eventual demise under suspicious circumstances. Her subsequent experiences included time in an isolated facility, where she received basic education from an English-speaking instructor named Jack, who taught her reading through children's literature. This education came with concerning conditions that highlighted the complex power dynamics at play. When Jimmy sought to discuss her past hardships, Oryx consistently redirected the conversation with philosophical observations like, "We should think only beautiful things," and "All experiences shape who we become." Her serene acceptance frustrated Jimmy, who struggled to reconcile her perspective with his own emotional response to her history. When confronted about whether she appeared in certain controversial online content Jimmy had encountered years before, Oryx remained deliberately ambiguous, noting that many young people shared similar experiences. Her response, "It might be me, Maybe it is. Would that make you happy, Jimmy? Exemplified her careful navigation of personal history. Oryx symbolizes both human resilience and the complexity of processing difficult experiences. Her forward-looking perspective stands in stark contrast to Jimmy's preoccupation with historical trauma, highlighting different approaches to managing challenging past experiences. After years of separation, Craik and Jimmy's paths converge again when Craik recruits Jimmy to work on advertising for the Bliss Plus pill at Rejuvenus. The pill was designed to protect against sexually transmitted diseases, enhance libido and energy, and prolong youth, with a secret fourth function, sterilization without users' knowledge, to help control overpopulation. Behind this commercial venture lay Craik's true masterwork, the Paradise Project. In a blind, eyeball-like dome surrounded by tropical splices with ultra-tight security, Craik had created a new species of humans. Through the one-way mirror in Craik's office, Jimmy got his first glimpse of beautiful, naked humans of all skin colors moving without self-consciousness in an artificial paradise complete with simulated sky, moon phases, and rain. Craik explained these floor models were the culmination of 7 years of research, genetically engineered humans programmed to die suddenly at 30 without illness, lacking territoriality, racism, and sexual torment. They came into heat at regular intervals, needed no tools or houses, ate only vegetation, and even recycled their own excrement. When Jimmy questioned whether parents would want such features in their children, Craik explained these were just demonstrations. Customers could customize their babies, selecting desired traits. The Paradise Project represented Craik's vision for humanity's future. The Bliss Plus pill would eliminate haphazard reproduction, while Paradise offered a superior method of creating humans. Craik had assembled a team of brilliant scientists to work on the project, all with code names from extinct species. Jimmy realized these scientists were the Extinctathon Grandmasters who formed Mad Atom, the group behind various bioterrorist acts. Craik had recruited them before the Corpse Corps could, offering secure papers and new identities. Among the staff was Oryx, who taught botany and zoology to the Craikers, appearing naked because clothes would confuse them. Jimmy realized with sinking heart that Craik was in love with her, having found her through student services at Watson Crick, specifically requesting someone resembling the girl from Hot Tots they once watched together. Despite knowing she was off-limits as Craik's lover, Jimmy began an affair with Oryx when she seduced him, explaining, "I didn't want to see you so unhappy." When Jimmy worried about betraying Craik, she dismissed his concerns. "Craik lives in a higher world. He has no time to play. You are for fun." She maintained this double relationship, briefing Craik on her business trips distributing Bliss Plus pills through sex clinics before secretly visiting Jimmy's room. This triangle of desire and deception would ultimately trigger the apocalypse as Craik's scientific ambition collided with Jimmy's emotional needs and Oryx's enigmatic presence. The catastrophe, when it came, was swift and devastating. While waiting for Oryx to return with takeout pizza one evening, Jimmy learned of a catastrophic worldwide plague breaking out simultaneously in cities across the globe. Oryx called him crying, revealing the disease was in the Bliss Plus pills she had been distributing. Craik called next, sounding drunk, saying, "Everything's under control." Jimmy secured the Paradise facility, locking out three staff members to protect the Craikers. As dawn approached, Craik appeared at the airlock, demanding entry. When Jimmy refused, citing contamination fears, Craik revealed Jimmy was immune because the antibody serum was in the plebe vaccine Jimmy had been taking. Jimmy let Craik in, only to witness him enter with Oryx, whose throat Craik slits before Jimmy's eyes. Jimmy immediately shot Craik dead. Sealed inside Paradise with the Craikers, Jimmy watched helplessly as the pandemic unfolded, quarantines failing, hospitals closing, communication networks collapsing. He tried calling emergency hotlines and even his estranged father, but all lines were dead. On satellite, he watched as points of light, representing functioning communities, blinked out one by one. The virus, engineered by Craik and hidden in the Bliss Plus pills, spread with unprecedented speed. Craik had designed it to be airborne after the initial infection, ensuring maximum transmission. This waterless flood, as Jimmy later called it when creating myths for the Krakers, wiped out humanity while leaving the natural world intact, exactly as Craik had intended. Living off emergency supplies and numbing himself with drugs and alcohol, Jimmy struggled to process the extinction of humanity happening before his eyes. He found himself oddly detached from the global suffering, more preoccupied with personal questions about Oryx and Craik's motives. Had Craik planned this all along? Was Oryx a willing accomplice or an unwitting pawn? Jimmy would never know for certain. In March, after marking days on a calendar, Jimmy finally revealed himself to the Krakers, introducing himself as Snowman, a new identity to help him forget his past and exist only in the present. He led them out of paradise to the seashore, where they could establish a new life away from the ruins of civilization. As the sole guardian of the Krakers, Snowman finds himself in the unexpected role of prophet and mythmaker. These genetically perfect beings, designed by Craik to replace flawed humanity, need explanations for the world they now inhabit. Snowman creates a cosmology centered on Craik as creator and Oryx as a nurturing mother of animals. Using a plastic pail with muddy water to represent chaos, he explains how the old world was chaotic, with too many people killing each other and eating the children of Oryx even when not hungry. He describes how Craik cleared away the dirt in the Great Rearrangement to make room for his children and the children of Oryx. The Krakers respond with liturgical enthusiasm. Oh, good, kind Craik. Snowman feels enraged by their adulation of Craik, adulation he himself invented. The Craik they worship is his fabrication, partly created out of spite, knowing Craik was against the notion of God. He wonders bitterly why they don't glorify him instead, since he was the one who saved them. But he can't revise the mythology now. They demand dogma, and he's become Craik's prophet whether he likes it or not. Despite Craik's attempts to engineer out symbolic thinking, the Krakers develop religious behaviors anyway. When Snowman returns from a supply run to Paradise, he discovers them sitting in a semicircle around a crude effigy made with a jar-lid face and mop beard, a representation of himself. They've created primitive musical instruments from beach debris and explain they called him with their voices and made his image to help. Snowman remembers Craik's warning about symbolic thinking leading to idols, funerals, and eventually slavery and war. The irony isn't lost on him. Craik's perfect humans are already developing the very traits he tried to eliminate. When they ask about his journey into the sky, Snowman improvises, claiming Craik now lives in paradise as a tree with a mouth. Through his mythmaking, Snowman preserves fragments of human culture while shaping the Krakers' understanding of their world. He becomes the bridge between the extinct human civilization and this new beginning, a reluctant Adam teaching innocence in a fallen Eden. As Snowman struggles with infection and starvation, a startling revelation changes everything. Abraham Lincoln, one of the Krakers, casually mentions that others like you came here. Jolted awake from his fever-induced drowsiness, Snowman learns that other humans visited the Krakers, people wearing clothes, including a bearded man and a woman who smelled blue. The Krakers describe the encounter nonchalantly, not understanding its significance, comparing the strangers to rabbits. When Snowman asks where the strangers went, they point along the beach. Despite his infected foot and weakened condition, Snowman realizes he must investigate these strangers. Moving cautiously from tree to tree, he discovers human footprints in the sand, several different sizes, some wearing shoes or sandals. As he approaches their camp, he sees three thin, battered-looking people, two men, one brown, one white, and a tea-colored woman in tattered clothes, roasting a raccoon over a fire. Their spray gun lies on the ground nearby. Feverish and shivering, Snowman contemplates his options: approach peacefully, try to trade, or threaten them to leave. He realizes that with three against one, any hostile move would likely end with them killing him later. As he hesitates, whispering, "What do you want me to do?" to the empty air, he hears Oryx's voice in his memory. "Don't let me down." Looking at his blank watch face, he thinks, 0 hour, time to go, preparing to reveal himself to the strangers. The novel ends on this ambiguous note, Snowman poised between hope and fear, the future of humanity hanging in the balance. Will these survivors form a new community? Will they threaten the crackers? Or will human nature, with all its flaws and potential for violence, reassert itself in this new world? The final image of Snowman preparing to step forward represents the eternal human dilemma, the choice between isolation and community, between safety and risk. Despite everything he's witnessed, despite Crake's attempt to replace humanity with something better, Snowman still feels the pull of human connection. In this moment, he embodies both the end of one world and the possible beginning of another, the last man standing at the crossroads of extinction and rebirth.